I guess that it's possible that dumpster diving and ticket scalping helped me build a base of skills that didn't hurt when I started in what we could call very unfairly the dirty business of politics a couple of decades later.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight.
My guest today is Nathaniel G. Perlman, the host of the Great Battlefield Podcast and an entrepreneur with an interest in and commitment to progressive politics. For 999 episodes, I've been the interviewer, talking to a variety of great people working to protect and improve our democracy. For this 1,000th episode, I get to be the guest on my own show. A number of people had suggested at various times that I have someone else interview me for an episode, saying they would like to hear more from me. I've been resistant to that, and I've also dodged a lot of invites to talk on other shows. But as I approached this milestone, I wanted to find a way to mark the occasion. I thought about bringing on a special guest, maybe one to berate, but neither Donald Trump nor Stephen Miller accepted my invite. So my next idea was to ask former guests and maybe a few others to do a group interview of me. So a fair number, too many really, have submitted questions in audio form. Some were straightforward, some were challenging or provocative, and some were out of my expertise. But I'm trying to answer them all. I'm stitching those questions and answers together into an episode. Actually, I decided to break this up into more than one episode, with the first today being the biographical and some personal and fun questions. Lou Levine, who was my first employee and who tells me that he listens to this podcast a fair amount, leads off. He got overexcited and asked me a whole series of the basic biographical questions, as well as others that I haven't even gotten a chance to look at yet. So I'll follow this episode 1000 with another episode next week, which takes on all the questions that I got about entrepreneurship, politics, democracy, the progressive ecosystem, including Bonterra / NGP Van and the technology part of that space. Of course, if you could care less about me as a subject or my thoughts about these things, you can just wait and listen to my next upcoming guest, who's Sasha Eisenberg, the author of the new book, The Lie Detectives, which is a timely account of the people on our side who've been working to defend us against disinformation. Or if you haven't yet listened to the guest before me, Anne Lewis was excellent. She built an extremely successful digital consulting and fundraising data company called Mission Wired that helps our side after a notable career in politics and government. If you were not among those asking me questions so far, feel free to send me the audio of your own question and I'll try to fit it in. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, this is episode 1000, or maybe just 8 in base 2, the biographical and personal part of the interview with Nathaniel, host of the Great Battlefield Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
All right. Hey, Nathaniel. Congrats on your 1,000th episode. I'm Lou Levine, your first employee at NGP Van. I don't know when we did a podcast, but it was a long time ago, back in person when we did those things. But on the event of your 1,000th episode, I figured I would throw back at you some of the questions you always ask people, because there's a lot more to you than people realize, and you've been doing it for a very long time. So, Nathaniel, why don't you introduce yourself and give me a brief biography?
Hi, Lou. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. I added the G to match my first company, National Geographical and Political Software. As you know, I usually avoid being on this side of the microphone, as I much prefer learning about others than talking about myself. As to brief bio, the relevant part is that in the spring of 2017, I started the Great Battlefield Podcast, and have worked my way diligently to this, the 1000th episode. Before that, let's see, after college, I worked a couple of early programming jobs in political tech. I then went to graduate school where I met my wife-to-be, Connie. I followed her to DC at the end of 1996. In the beginning of 1997, I started NGP Software. In August of 1999, about 2.5 years in, I hired you, Lou, when I couldn't handle all the work alone anymore. Connie and I got married in 2000. Connie and I had our first daughter in 2002. The company grew well for that first decade. I worked as CTO for Hillary's first presidential run in 2007, and I hired Stu Trevelyan to run the day-to-day of NGP in my absence. I sold most of NGP in 2009, and Stu became CEO, and I phased gradually out of that company. Connie and I had our second daughter that year. Still working at NGP, I started Time Plots, making political data graphic posters. With Mark Sullivan and Jim St. George, we merged NGP with Van, I think in 2010. In 2012, I started the data visualization services company called Graphicacy. So my various hobbies, Graphicacy and Great Battlefield and some advisory and board work are what I do now.
Where did you grow up? What type of family did you come from?
Well, to extend that quick biography, I was born in 1965 in Manhattan, New York, and I've seen cute pictures of me toddling around Riverside Park, but my parents, who were both teachers, moved to Boulder, Colorado just as I was about to turn 4. I grew up in scenic Boulder under the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. I had a lovely childhood, really, full of good fortune, though not a lot of extra dollars. We lived in a safe environment. I had great parents, excellent siblings, and really compatible friends from all over our neighborhood. The area was University Hill, next to the Colorado University campus. My life was attending the local public schools and reading lots of books. When I was little, we visited the Boulder Public Library to load up a stack each weekend, and I later headed to Norland Library at CU for research projects. I was also the type who read the newspaper every day, even in elementary school. Competitiveness was cultivated, and I played a lot of sports and games, street football, playground basketball and softball, and a lot of organized soccer. Not to mention the numerous real and invented games I played against my brother, like sock basketball and one-on-one wiffle ball and ping pong. Family discussions cultivated a liberal outlook and a sense that your job in the world should involve trying to improve things for others. History didn't impinge on us much in Boulder, but a weird thing happened in 1974. Someone bombed and destroyed my Flatirons Elementary School second grade classroom. It happened at night, so no one was hurt, and I don't remember it affecting my sense of safety at all. In politics, I remember going with my parents to vote for McGovern in 72, being moved by Ted Kennedy's convention speech in 1980, seeing my mom cry when Reagan won that year, and really rooting for Gary Hart, the Colorado senator, when he ran for president in 1984 and nearly got the nomination. I supported him again in 1987 until he was forced out of the race. Maybe the best part of my childhood was the very long summers. My parents rented our house in Boulder and drove us 4 days and 2,000 miles to a farm in Vermont that they shared with my aunt and uncle, who were potters. So in Vermont, I played outside all day with my siblings and visiting cousins, made things out of clay, learned about nature, helped plant and later consume vegetables out of the garden, practiced rough carpentry, building small cabins sometimes, and learning how to behave from extended family, including multiple aunts and uncles. My family also felt very symmetrical. I have one brother, Ben, and one sister, Eve. My dad, who taught English literature, had two brothers. My mom, who taught mathematics, she had two sisters. My parents gave us a kind of stability, which I realize in retrospect was a very great gift. All those years in Boulder were full of routines, like family meals together, and always that emphasis on learning, work, and fun. That stability extended to my friendships, very much both male and female, many of them dating back to first grade and continuing to today. I absorbed a lot from these friends, and I appreciate that they tolerated my quirks and included me in their activities. An exception to our family routine was that when I was about 10, we spent a year in Canterbury, England, when my dad had a job exchange with a professor at the University of Kent. That year gave me a lot more perspective, I guess, and I learned, very importantly, to play soccer, my favorite sport from that age until my early 40s. And I played on numerous teams, including my high school team, over the years. I'm not nearly as disciplined or steady as my parents were, but there are many things I have turned out to be persistent about. And lately, producing 3 episodes a week of this podcast has really been helpful in structuring my time. It became really useful for me later when interviewing political technology entrepreneurs that around 1981, my parents bought the family an Apple II Plus personal computer. This was when home computers were new, rare, and miraculous. It was a financial stretch for our family to acquire, I think, but I really got into it and it occupied a lot of my time. I'm very glad that rather than becoming a gamer, I worked at understanding the machine, becoming over time a self-taught programmer when that was not at all fashionable. I learned to write code in AppleSoft Basic and 6502 assembly language. That facility led to most of my pre-college jobs. I taught some private computer programming lessons when I was in high school, and I spent 2 summers as a teenage teacher of kids both younger and older than me at the new Rocky Mountain computer camps. I remember that for a Boulder High School dance, I wrote a program to match each student based on their answers to a questionnaire with a list of their 10 most compatible peers. My Epson MX80 dot matrix printer screeched all night putting those lists onto paper, and I slept next to it to make sure it didn't fail. So, Lou, through high school, I was a decently smart and well-rounded guy, though you would doubtless recognize me. A tad odd, sometimes quite a procrastinator, but willing to work hard on things that I found interesting. I was pretty shy, and I had very little sign whatsoever of leadership abilities.
So, in preparation for this, I went to go look at your LinkedIn, and it was sparse, but I know you came east for college. What drew you to Yale?
Well, to be honest, I got very lucky to find my way to Yale for college. It turned out to be a good fit for me. Most importantly, I made a lot of lifelong friends. At Yale, I majored in computer science, which was a challenge and quite time-consuming, and a lot of people left that major. Fortunately, programming had been my hobby before I got there, and a lot of times it didn't really seem like work. I had teachers like Professor Alan Perlis, with whom I took an intensive introduction to computer science. He was an early pioneer in developing programming languages. But most of my classwork was actually outside my major, where I had broad interests, especially in American history. I took only a few classes in political science. A sign of my politics was that I took American labor history and a sociology class on inequality and opportunity in American society. But for classes like that, I tended to procrastinate the papers, though I wasn't terrible at writing them once 2 a.m. rolled around. I remember back in 1986, I researched the history of computers in politics and wrote a paper on it for the noted scholar of Congress, Professor David Mayhew, back when that history was quite early and computers had a small role. I was looking for ways to intersect my interest in politics and tech even then. And I took a class with Professor Edward Tufte, the author of several great books about the visual display of quantitative information, which later led me to time plots and graphicacy. My senior project in computer science in college purported to use computational geometry for redistricting.
One of the things I know that wasn't on your LinkedIn is you got some early exposure to organizing in your time at PIRG in Colorado. So can you talk about that and how that shaped your outlook on organizing and politics? And what else did you learn from that?
Yeah, That summer that I canvassed door-to-door for Koperg was pretty formative. I went from being really nervous going up to strangers' doors and robotic about following my prescribed rap to a much more interactive communicator. My brother and some of his friends worked at that job too, and we all competed for fundraising results on a daily basis. So the job had a lot of camaraderie running from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m., and then we often all went out together afterwards. I learned enough about neighborhoods and working turf that summer to relate better to the many people I've talked to who came up on the field side of politics who I've interviewed over the past 7 years. Like anyone, I have stories. I met a few people that summer who struck me at the time as really weird humans, like one who had hundreds of birds in the front room of his house, or the person behind an open door who lay naked on a couch in a room a couple feet deep with hoarding stuff. But mostly I saw normal, well-meaning, and generous people who were willing to have a conversation about environmental stuff, even if they didn't necessarily see eye to eye at the outset. It was really a lesson in political geography, and we did notice how, in general, people were much more generous in average neighborhoods with Toyota Corollas in front and yards full of toys than those who had gates and perfect grass and fancy houses well back from the street.
During the 90s, you spent a lot of time working for political technology firms that were 1990s political technology firms. How did you get involved there? Can you talk about some of the experience there and like how did you land in political technology in the first place?
Well, fatefully, in the spring of my junior in college, that's 1987, I was looking for a job to combine my interest in politics and computers. I went to the College Career Center where I found a small political campaign software firm advertising a summer programming job in Washington, D.C. When I went down, I was romanced by the sight of the monuments in D.C. at night. That summer of work led to my first job after college where I continued working for that company. I worked for that firm for 2 years as a programmer. I designed and built and supported a political campaign software database to run on Mac computers. I concentrated on fundraising, list management, and compliance. I was ultimately fired shortly after I was set to build their next generation of IBM compatible software, probably because they had granted me a royalty on anything I built and decided that giving away that much was a bad idea. I did learn quite a bit about small business and the political software market of that day and age, as well as quite a few lessons about how I might do things differently.
Also, when I was looking at your LinkedIn, it said, you know, you worked at Election Data Services. And I know you also had a big interest in redistricting and boundaries. What got you interested in redistricting, and talk about some of the things you've done there that people might not know about?
My next job, which I found within a week of being fired, was also as a programmer. This was at a Democratic political redistricting consulting firm called Election Data Services. I was only an okay employee there, doing a lot of work processing data rather than building software, but I got very interested in redistricting and voting rights and political boundaries and election returns, and I read a lot of political science journal articles. I enjoyed interacting with the geographers who were mapping precincts to census blocks, and I observed a lot about another area of the intersection of politics and computers and software. Many years later, at Time Plots, I tackled some of the ideas I had then, like displaying a visual history of the U.S. Senate. It's also there that I got the notion to apply to graduate school in political science. Kim Brace, the founder and longtime owner of Election Data Services, was a guest on this podcast not that long ago. I really have enjoyed catching up with people like Kim from different points in my past to reconnect through an interview.
How did you wind up at MIT?
How did I wind up at MIT? Well, after Election Data Services, I moved back to Boulder and lived in my parents' house for a year while they were in D.C., I think. I wrote another political software package as a contractor for a different firm, maintaining ownership of the source code and having a royalty agreement as well. During that winter, I applied to some graduate political science programs. I got into just one of the five that I tried, that was MIT. I was never really persuaded that it was the right long-term direction for me, but I enjoyed my classes and I appreciated the professors and fellow students, as well as being back in an educational environment. I was pretty lucky as a graduate student because the political software I'd written the year before, which was sold under the name Landslide, produced royalties and ongoing contract work, which made me a comparatively rich graduate student, able to buy music CDs when I wanted, for example, and to rent my own apartment. I learned quite a bit more about American political history and statistics and models of politics, as well as the professional literature in political science in those areas. The background in graduate political science and the tools of social science has definitely helped me feel more up to interviewing professors and reporters and other political analysts and practitioners. And I made more friends at MIT. Happily, Connie Chang was in that same program. And after being friends for about a year and a half, we started dating and have been together for about a week short of exactly 30 years now. It was actually Connie, who was considering her own podcast interviewing scientists about a decade ago, that made me think of doing one of my own. Anyway, after 4 years, I finished my coursework and squeaked through my exams, but I left the program without writing a dissertation and followed Connie to DC.
In 1997, you started NGP Software. Why did you pick that name? But also, why did you decide to start your own thing? You had been working on this for other people. What led you to start your own? What led you to make it a partisan company when that was not the norm back there?
When I started NGP, ancient history now, I was just trying to employ myself so I didn't have to get a job. As to the name, I joked earlier that I added G to my initials to match the company, but the truth is that G stands for Goss, my mom's maiden name and my middle name, and I'd consulted under NGP Software for a few years, so I tried to find a phrase that would match my initials. I'd loosely thought about founding my own firm for years, having built software before several times to be sold by others, where the run of experiences was sometimes disappointing, politically unsatisfying, or dishonest or subpar. So I thought I might try it a different way, and I wrote myself a list of exhortations that I put on the wall about how I wanted to conduct myself in the world. One of them was the partisan angle, to work for the Democratic side of the force. That was just so I could sleep well at night. I got the company going slowly because there was a lot for me to learn. It's really hard for me to condense the story, but every day I made something happen. Finding a client, designing and improving the software, answering tech support calls, doing all the stuff for 2.5 years before hiring you, Lou, my first employee. I wrote the story of NGP up to the merger with Van as a chapter in my edited book, Margin of Victory. Mark Sullivan wrote up the Van side, which is a different chapter. I can't duplicate that here in a couple of minutes. If you want a copy of the book, ask me. I still have some that I can give away or lend out. Or probably I can just make a PDF of the relevant chapters if you happen to be among the very small group of those who are curious about the history of the space. Companies are like living, breathing creatures. And sometimes NGP was beautiful and graceful, and often it felt like an unbroken horse trying to shake its riders.
Can you talk about the political tech landscape back in the late 1990s, early 2000s? You were an upstart company. I didn't come along until you had like 50, 60 customers, but it was a very small company back then. How did you look at the market? How did you look at growing the business? And how did you see yourself growing in the space?
God, it was different then. You remember this as well as I do. You were the one that told me that eventually we were going to get everyone to use us. I had started by helping fundraising firms manage their lists. They then recommended us to their campaigns, and I added compliance. There were a whole bunch of companies that sold political campaign software back then, and all but one were very small. Some of them went back to the early 80s. All were desktop or client server based until the early 2000s. Web-based software just started happening in politics when we were about 5 or 6 years into things. And then for years, we had all the incoming campaigns moving to us from all the other vendors and challengers picking us. And many of the other firms eventually went away or gave up on the Democratic side of the business if they were bipartisan. It was a many, many cycle slog, but it made us a juggernaut, a term one client used. And we had to go through it all over again with the web-based toolset, including converting our own desktop clients over to that. Around the time the Dean campaign was taking off in 2003 is when we had the beta web-based product. And Mark went through a very parallel development with Van, competing against six or seven other voter file management firms and winning. Speaking to the other entrepreneurs out there who have companies that have traction in their market, it's really an amazing feeling, but never a dull moment and never easy.
You were Hillary Clinton's first chief technology officer on her presidential run. How did that happen? And why did you want to step away from NGP Software at the time? What led to that decision? What were you thinking then?
I was asked to be Hillary's CTO in that 2007-2008 primary because they knew me, particularly Shelley. She ran the budget and compliance operation. They knew me from providing our software to Hillary's Senate campaigns in 2000 and 2006, as well as to her political action committee. I was seriously on the fence about accepting the job because I was in such a good spot at NGP and I'd never worked on a big campaign before, much less a presidential. I ultimately took it with the idea that I could make sure that their compliance operation and their fundraising operation would use our services and that I would learn how to help the other departments with technology. It was a very hard job for me, but I did learn a lot and met a lot of good people. I pretty frequently went back to check in on NGP, my company, and it seemed like such a friendly respite in those times. My biggest takeaway, that was really excellent preparation for interviewing other presidential campaign staffers for this podcast many cycles later.
When you came back from the Hillary campaign, what was that like? How did that process go? It's obviously very different after you've stepped away from the company and stepped back.
Yeah, it was different. I was a little lost, to be honest, and trying to sort out how to behave with employees and with Stu. I'd hired him to help run things in my absence, and the two of you and the whole gang were doing fine without me. In 2007, during the campaign, I remembered that we had our company 10th anniversary party at the National Press Club in D.C. Stu and I spoke, and so did my wife, Connie, who is quite a bit better at it than either of us, as anyone who attended might remember. I'd been at the cardiologist earlier that day for a big test because something wasn't right. That was the day I first thought about selling some or all of the company, which Stu helped make happen about 2 years later. If anyone out there is in a similar situation and is considering selling something that they built and care about, I welcome you talking to me as I've learned a lot from that process and what followed. In fact, I've talked to a lot of people who've been that or thought about it on this podcast, and I think that going through it myself was really a prerequisite for understanding and carrying on those conversations.
What is time plots? What is Graphicacy? What's the difference between the two?
So when I was considering selling NGP, I went through a lot of thought experiments trying to see how I would feel on the other side. I thought I might experience some loss of identity or be unsure what to do with myself. So I did a bunch of things. I stayed at NGP for a long time as a minor owner and board member, and people tolerated me remaining there. I started time plots in 2009 in my office in the corner, and later with my employees working in the hallway. Timeplots made some rather awesome political data graphic posters. I'm proud of them, and they found their way into some cool places like the U.S. Supreme Court. But it was a good thing I didn't have to count on it for a living. In 2012, we turned Timeplots into Graphicacy, building data explorers and doing data visualization and related work online for a lot of cool clients. I've tried to be much more hands-off with this company than I was with NGP, so that I can do a lot of different things. That business also started slowly with lots of hiccups, but now, more than a decade later, we have a really strong team, great clients, and have grown to 11 people. So Graphicacy is the services side compared to time plots. Just like if you have one kid, you think you know how to be a parent, But if you have many, you realize they're all different and require different things of you. So it is with companies. And service companies are quite different than product companies. It's all more perspective to bring to the podcast.
Why did you want to start this podcast? What led you to that decision, and why was that the right medium for you?
Well, when I decided to start the podcast, I again did not know what I was doing. In fact, I don't think I'd ever listened to one, though I knew the theory. I was with Connie and my kids and some other friends on a weekend in Chincoteague when I wrote what became episode zero. I wanted to find a way to follow and help the resistance to Trump, and I thought this might be it. During that time when I had been gradually disengaging from NGP, I'd also worked on a documentary film interviewing entrepreneurs in other parts of the economy, which helped me understand that I like to do that. But the podcast being audio only has really stuck with me. I just really like the learning and the challenge and the people. I do it for myself, and I'm delighted whenever I learn that someone else has listened. And I have such a varied background in progressive politics that I can often figure out some of the right questions. For this 1,000th episode, it's been fun to contemplate all the hours I've put in, and fun to ask people to send audio questions to me and see what they are, and just plain work to try to answer them.
Hey, Nathaniel. Amy Pritchard here from Gain Power and Amplify Power. Former guest, longtime friend, and huge admirer of the great battlefield. I want to first congratulate you on producing 1,000 episodes. That's quite a feat by any standard. And I want to thank you as a person who has really benefited from learning about some of the folks that you've interviewed that I've had a chance to listen to. So I understand it's our chance to turn the tables on you, and I'd love to ask you a few questions. My first is really personal. I'm curious how you're doing. I understand you took a break because of some health problems. And obviously, just as a friend, I'm worried about you, and I'd love to understand more about how you're doing.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for the kind words. I'm really glad we've bumped into each other along the way, and I appreciate your contributions to our politics and to our progressive ecosystem. As to my health, I have to report that at 58, I'm feeling fairly annoyed with my body and brain, even though I recognize I have a lot to be grateful for. Last year was tough because I had a brain tumor and then 10 hours of microsurgery to remove it last March 28th. That's what caused me to move from 3 episodes a week to 1 so I could keep things going. I discovered the tumor because the hearing in my left ear started going away from August 2022 until January 2023. That increasing hearing loss was a mystery until I finally got sent out to take an MRI. That scan discovered that I had a 2.8 centimeter acoustic neuroma, or vestibular schwannoma as it is more properly called, stretching like an ice cream cone into my inner ear and pushing over to my brainstem, which I've learned is an important body part. Surgery seemed like the best choice for a growth of that size. I got lucky in that my 2 Johns Hopkins surgeons preserved my facial nerve, kept me free of infection and spinal fluid leak, or many of the scary complications that do sometimes happen. However, it was still pretty unpleasant, and I'm still recovering almost a year later. I've gotten back my sense of taste, which was disrupted for a while, and I'm able to do most everything I could beforehand. I'm left with an ongoing but bearable set of annoyances, including permanent loss of hearing on my left side, a literal numbskull with very little feeling in my scalp from the incision to the top of my head, daily headaches, which are usually quite bearable, the muscles on my neck and around my head often feel extremely tight, and there is some work left to adapt to the loss of the left side balance nerve, which makes me feel mildly seasick parts of every day. Generally, I'm all right. And to complain just a little about the surgeons, my wife's request that they fix my personality while they were in there went unattended to. There is hope that some of my remaining symptoms will go away over time. The end of this month, on the year anniversary, I have a follow-up MRI. That should show whether this tumor is coming back. If it is, I'll need radiation to stop it, but I should be okay. As brain tumors go, this was a relatively minor one and apparently benign, so it should not spread. I really feel for people who face much bigger health challenges, including the far nastier brain tumors that are out there. The experience really did remind me how much I care for my family and friends and want to stick around, and how much support is available to me when something goes wrong. I'm very, very grateful for everyone who helped take care of me during this year and very happy to be able to do almost all of the things that I want to do now.
This is Jess O'Connell with Nuco Strategies. Nathaniel, I'm wondering if you were an entrepreneur when you were a child, and if so, what was your first business?
Hi, Jess. Thanks for the question. And it's really good to see a former DNC CEO now as a political entrepreneur. People should be alert for an upcoming episode with you and some of your team talking about a new thing you're incubating at Nuco. As to my first business, my family of origin was not at all business oriented, actually pretty anti-business, I'd say. But my brother and I found some creative ways of making money as young kids that were fairly entrepreneurial in retrospect. One was that in the pre-deposit days of aluminum cans, the liquor mart in Boulder would pay a modest amount by weight for large quantities of aluminum cans. So my brother and I would climb into the dumpsters in the alleys all over our neighborhood, which was populated by a lot of fraternities and sororities. We would extract from the other waste and pizza boxes and bees what we called pop cans like Coke and the plentiful beer cans, Olympia and Busch and Schlitz. We would crush the cans by stomping them to save space and drag big plastic bags of them back home. Our parents would later drive us to the liquor mart with them. I think we would make maybe $25 a run. The most lucrative business-like activity was related to the Colorado University college football season and the Big Eight home games at Folsom Field. My brother and I, and quite a number of other neighborhood kids, starting at about 10 years old, scalped tickets. It was quite a tutorial in a fairly complex market, very time sensitive, and required a certain amount of assertiveness and upfront investment. You had to know the value of the opposing team, with Oklahoma and Nebraska fans, for example, being the most willing to pay high prices. You had to learn how to acquire tickets either by begging for people's extras or buying them from regular fans or other scalpers. And obviously, different seating locations had very different values, and you had to negotiate quickly with buyers. You also had to time things so you didn't get stuck with them. You had very active competition. There weren't many home games in the season, but we could land $200, say, in a couple hours on a good day, which was an astonishing sum to us. I have to say that in both of these cases, that while money was part of the motivation, it was a lot more the adventure of the activity that motivated us. I guess that it's possible that dumpster diving and ticket scalping helped me build a base of skills that didn't hurt when I started in what we could call very unfairly the dirty business of politics a couple of decades later.
Hey, Nathaniel, this is Alex from Ballot Ready. I have two questions for you. One thing I admire about you a lot is how good you are at building community. You bring together people from all parts of your life, your friends from childhood, former employees from over 20 years ago, people you meet on your podcast, like me. My question is, how are you so good at that, and what do you do to make that happen? And my second question is, when can we play disc golf again? Thanks. Bye.
Hi, Alex. First of all, I'm almost always up for disc golf with you or with anyone else who happens to like that sport who happens to be listening. I appreciate your question about friendship, which feels like a genuine compliment and makes me wish I'd asked more people about that on the podcast. You've gotten to know me through our entrepreneur forum, and you've been to a few of my bonfires in Vermont. I suspect that you recognize from those things that I can be a pretty shy person in group settings, but that I've found a lot of people to care for. I think by nature, I'm an introvert with somewhat suspect social skills. Fortunately, I've been able to glom onto some friendship groups growing up in Boulder and in college and through sports and work, where others take the lead in maintaining things, though I'm also pretty good at bringing others in. And I married someone with lots of close friends who has good skills in that area, and we have couple friends and individual friends in common, as well as independent friendships, which is a good balance. When I run into people that I like, and that's pretty often, I try to expand our acquaintance or find ways to hang on to them. Sometimes they reciprocate. I like to learn about people and follow the plots of their lives, and I've gotten better at sharing about my own. My dad tells me that his father said not to miss the opportunity to do people a favor. I've taken that to heart. I wish I were a little less erratic about reaching out to people, but life gets busy and I look for opportunities like the bonfires to make invites. Maybe more to the point, I think that I've learned to appreciate people for who they are and to accept the kind of friendship that seems to fit with each individual. With you, Alex, we met through the podcast interview originally. And because you accepted my invites to a couple different activities, we've grown to know each other a lot better. Recently, you gave me the opening to play disc golf, so I took you up on it, as we did the other day. Many of my good friends do more than their fair share of maintaining our friendship, and I really thank them for that. In general, I just try to stay in touch with people who seem to reciprocate my positive feelings and inclination to hang out.
When you started NGP, there were other products for campaign fundraising compliance, but yours eventually dominated the market. What do you think you did right? Is there anything you would have done differently if you had the opportunity to start again?
Hi, Nathan Woodhull. I know you've started a number of things in the political technology space, including Daisy Chain, as we've talked about on the podcast, and I appreciate this question from you. In retrospect, even though I knew very little about business in 1997 when I started NGP, I did a lot of things right. I'd worked for some competitors, so I knew the market, and I knew some things that they were doing wrong. In today's terminology, I bootstrapped and built a lean startup. That is, I didn't raise any money, I built a small initial product, I sold it to clients, and then added the things that they wanted to it, while maintaining a general vision for where I was going. And after a couple of years, I hired good people, and together we figured out how to go forward. I think the main secret was trying to provide good technical support, to be honest, which is really just a key part of trying to do your best for the clients you care about. And I was definitely competitive in trying to win while being a good citizen in the market. What would I do differently? Man, that was a fun time, especially to about the first 15 or 20 people or so, but actually the whole first decade in truth. I wouldn't trade that for anything. And despite my mistakes along the way, we did incredibly well. And truthfully, I got too much positive in my life out of NGP to deal with wishing that I had done something different. Because maybe everything else wouldn't have worked out if I had changed things. I don't want to spend any time being regretful for sure. But please do stay tuned to my answers to some of the questions I get asked about Bonterra.
Hey Nathaniel, it's Ashwath from Social Current. I'm so glad at the opportunity to interview you on the podcast. I had such a great time being on. When I talk to other entrepreneurs, I'm really curious what drives them. And I'm curious what drives you. What drove you when you were building NGP? And what drives you now? And has anything changed?
Hi Ashwath. Really glad to have met you through the podcast. What drove me at the start of NGP was primarily the need to make a living and not wanting to work for someone else. And then some combination of the positive feedback of landing clients that were meaningful to me, like Democratic members of Congress, and also getting good feedback from them, and the satisfaction of building a product that worked well and was alive and improving and responsive to the requests of customers, as well as winning in competition with other firms. Pushing the firm to grow and having that work was pretty fun. I was also driven by the learning that takes place as the company got more complicated and required more of me. And I guess I was also motivated by some element of fear, the fear of losing what I was building or going backwards, which I fortunately never experienced. Yeah, I think it is different for me now. Now I am more protective of my time and able to avoid things that I don't want to do most of the time. I protect having time to be with family or doing some various hobbies while keeping enough real life projects like advising other businesses or helping my company Graphicacy or spending a lot of time working on this podcast so that I continue to feel like I'm still learning and contributing something of value to the world. And just learning from you and others about the world of creator marketing to help progressives is part of that learning.
Hi, Nathaniel and listeners. I'm Drew Miller, and up until recently, I was the Senior Vice President of Engineering for NGP Van and Bonterra. My question for you is, had you never started NGP or gotten into political software, what would you have done instead, and how differently do you think your life would look today?
Hi, Drew. I was chatting with Connie today about this question and a few others that I got that are related. I'm not sure that I have the imagination to conjure up alternate realities that stray far from the one that I've experienced. But if I hadn't got into political software, and more to the point, maybe, political technology-related podcasting, I might have been an independent contract programmer and stay-at-home dad. That seems like it might have offered some income and independence and catered to my desire to be around my kids a lot. I don't know that my life would have been enormously different, as I've never needed a lot of extra money, and I've mostly been driven by avoiding the kind of work I dislike, and I might have been fine with this. Or, maybe, I would have discovered another area for building a company in. Who knows? The other alternative I should mention is that I did have a chance once upon a time to pursue professional basketball as a career. I think that if I'd put the time into that, I would have excelled enough in college to actually be drafted. A couple things would then have probably transpired for me. Perhaps with the help of a good sports psychologist, a nutritionist, and a fitness coach or two, I would have been able to put on the necessary muscle and height, and likely been a starter on one of the weaker teams. Maybe not quite on the level of Caron Butler, the former NBA All-Star, my guest in episode 872. But if I'd done that, I still think my life might look a bit like it does today. Just another aging guy thinking about his glory days.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Maura Ahrens-Mealy, host of the Anxious Achiever podcast, guest on your podcast, and a former political consultant who worked with you eons ago on campaigns. Nathaniel, when I got to be on your podcast, we talked about how the fact that you considered yourself introverted and shy were hard for you when you were starting your business. I'd love you to talk about how you sort of managed through that and how you've come to view what you called your shyness, but maybe isn't, as you've gotten older and reflected.
Hi, Maura. Thanks for the question. I like your podcast and book. And as we discussed, I relate to some of the leaders you interview who have to contend with their own internal challenges or frailties while trying to be a model for others and shape their organizations in positive ways. Yeah, I was and am still shy. I'm also definitely an introvert in that too much social interaction tires me out, though I also seek to be around people and to make social things happen, especially gatherings on my own terms with people I enjoy, like big cookouts in my backyard or my bonfire gatherings in Vermont. So those of you who share those characteristics with me should know that you can find your own way to be a leader and to be successful. My shyness does vary a bit by circumstance. Maybe related to that, I come from a family tradition that is very uncomfortable with and sensitive to bragging, though we are also proud of knowing things and sharing them. I've always had a hard time with marketing for that reason. I think I may have passed that on to my kids because while I think I'm overly modest, my kids think I brag too much. As it pertains to running a company, I remember really disliking conferences back in the day, feeling that I had to speak on panels, getting nervous before and during that, and hating to deal with large crowds of people that I did not know. I was rarely comfortable. Public speaking is a challenge for me. I thought I was tragically bad representing my nonprofit in speeches to groups of potential donors, but I thought I was pretty good at interviewing Mark Bezos, Jeff's brother, in front of a similar group. Not sure why. I'm much better one-on-one or in small groups or in environments where people know me. I've also learned that I can get better with practice, so can you. As I mentioned earlier, talking about canvassing with Koperg, I went from horrible there to quite good, and I believe that I've improved as a host of this podcast after 1,000 episodes because I'm starting to loosen up. I'm really helped by the fact that I know I can edit out my egregious mistakes. Do I have any words of wisdom? It has helped me to be open about this shyness to coworkers and others. I'm much more comfortable if I do not have to pretend to be other than I am.
Hi, Nathaniel. It's Tatenda from Voter Formation Project. Thanks so much for including me in this. And my question for you is, could you please tell us about your most difficult client throughout your entire career? You don't have to name names, although I would love it if you did. And if you could tell us what exactly happened with that client to make it so intensely difficult.
Hi, Tatenda. I like this question about difficult clients because often we learn the most from the most difficult situations that we encounter. Upon reflection, the most difficult clients that I've had to deal with have been mostly my fault, in that I should not have taken them as a client in the first place because they didn't fit the business as well as they should have, or because I was more concerned at the time with bringing in revenue to pay staff than to stand up to their being difficult. With NGP, for example, we made a group with a deal called PAN, I think. I can't remember what that stood for back in the early 2000s when we were small. The contract involved making a lot of modifications and customizations to our core software to serve them. And it turned out that those changes were not a good fit for our clients in general and would change the software for the worse. But they had paid me $50,000 upfront, and that was a very useful amount at the time. As we got into the details of the project, the client seemed difficult, and just how problematic the proposed changes were became increasingly clear. Our team wanted me to get out of the contract. I went to the client and had the difficult conversation. Understandably, they were not happy and went to their lawyer. And we had to, of course, give them back the $50,000. Plus, I agreed to pay them another $40,000, if I remember correctly, to make the problem go away. More recently, with Graphicacy, which is a service business, we had a client a number of years ago that was both cheap and difficult, but they made up a significant proportion of our business at the time. My staff really didn't want to work with them. We got better over time about standing up to them on price, and because of that, they mostly turned away from us as a vendor. But we were way better off once we replaced them with better clients. And those experiences definitely have made me a better advisor and perhaps a better interviewer of some kinds of entrepreneurs as well.
Hey, this is David Eichenbaum. So I'm always wondering where people like to travel. So I guess my question for you is, what are the top three places around the world that you would like to go to that you haven't been to yet?
Hi, David. That's a fun question to contemplate. One place I really want to go is Rapa Nui, or Easter Island. For decades, I've been making small sculptures out of clay, and some of them are quite influenced by the giant moai that are found on that island. The second place is China, particularly the Great Wall. There's something about these stone things constructed at giant scale in times before machines that fascinates me. Plus, my wife is Chinese American, and I'm embarrassed I haven't made it to China yet. For the third place to go, I'd like to ask my listeners, or maybe just Mark and Jim from the van, who've out-traveled all the rest of us combined, and with whom I hiked the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu, to make a suggestion. Where else should be a place on my top three list?
Nathaniel, having watched your two amazing daughters grow up to be wonderful adults, I'm just curious if you have any advice for people in my shoes with a 6 and 4-year-old amazing daughters, but with a lot of teenage years to come and a lot of growth ahead. So any sage words of wisdom for parents like me?
Hi, Aaron Strauss, formerly head of the Analyst Institute and now at Open Labs. I love that I've known you since you were just getting going in the political space, and now you're the almost grizzled kidney donor and father of two with a long history. I'm confident that no one is coming to this podcast for parenting advice, but it is true that I do have two exceptionally great daughters. My advice is try to be the best person you can be, because as a parent, you're a model, and the kids will emulate what you do more than what you say, and then give them sufficient space. Our kids know us better than anyone else, and as I am very imperfect, making way too many jokes that they think are unfunny and just being embarrassing in general, Despite all that, they know Connie and I love them. All kids, I think, especially notice how we handle our worst moments. So a lot of parenting is just trying to raise our own game as people, especially in the areas that matter most. By the way, I also asked Connie how to answer this. She says, A, to be consistent, and B, to work to cultivate a strong relationship between your two daughters and help them achieve clarity about how important that is. And my dad says, you don't know how you were as a parent until you see how your grandchildren turn out. Good luck.
Nathaniel, this is your father speaking. I would like to know why it is that you have told me in the past that you're a better employer than you were an employee.
Well, Dad, I must have thought about that a bit, or I wouldn't have mentioned it to you. I would put it that I've been happier when the project that I'm working on is something that I feel ownership and enough control over, which I sometimes did not feel as an employee. A feeling of ownership in a project helps motivate me and is something that I share with a lot of other entrepreneurs. I find that I'm much happier working on a smaller project that feels like mine than a large project where I feel that I'm a small cog in a big wheel. I came to understand this early enough in my career to locate different opportunities over time to either do my own solitary thing or gradually add people to an enterprise so that I could adapt to its changes over time. But also, like some entrepreneurs, I seem to like starting things that grow more than operating things that are big. When an enterprise becomes more about managing and holding people accountable and planning, I'm not as good a fit. I think a bigger business, even my own, makes me feel like an employee. I find people listen to me less, and it's more of a struggle to make change. When I talk to my kids, I emphasize looking for things in life that are truly a fit for them, not what others think we should be doing. When you like what you're doing in whatever role, I think you feel less like an employee and more like a team member. And in that employer-employee relationship, it's something that you said to me in my early 20s that I refer often to. You told me that employers think that they are doing their employees a favor by employing them, and that employees think that they're the ones doing the favor. I've tried to remember that it is a relationship of mutuality, and that has been helpful, I believe, in many instances.
Hey, Nathaniel, this is Chris, your podcast editor. I have a three-part question regarding the podcast. First, producing three podcasts a week is a lot of work. What keeps you going?
I don't know if anyone knows better than Christopher Lang how much work this podcast is, because I keep relentlessly throwing new episodes at him to edit. What I can say is it seems to be a fit for me. I get enjoyment from the challenge of conducting a good interview, and I know mine do vary. I like the process of hunting for new guests, of generating and editing transcripts to mark what I want to keep and discard from an interview's audio, though I don't really love the admin part of scheduling the interviews. I once heard the term pod fade, which apparently refers to people with podcasts who skip episodes or release them irregularly or less and less often until they stop. So I kind of dread pod fade, and three a week is just relentless enough of a pace that I can't stop to think about quitting. So you just have to add to that my obsession with the risks to our democracy and my interest and admiration for the people working to protect and improve it, and I keep going.
Second, is there a guest you would like to have on that you haven't, and why?
There are endless guests I would like to have on, and plenty that I would like to have on again. Some that I haven't gotten to or found the nerve to ask or even heard about their work. Here are a few that I'd like to include. So if anyone listening can introduce me or talk these people into coming on, do it. Jamie Raskin, Liz Cheney, Theda Scotchpole at Harvard, who studies these kinds of political organizations, Robert Reich, who's done a lot of resistance work, Emily Norman, Lindsay Shue Cortez, David Brock, or many other leaders at ecosystem organizations that I haven't gotten to yet. The current CEO at Bonterra, who for some reason still hasn't accepted my LinkedIn request, or members of their current board. Tim Snyder, the Yale history professor. Either of the two authors of the book How Democracies Die. any of the Democratic governors of red or purple states think they know something important. I'd also love to talk to any of the billionaires who fund progressive organizations. Marshall Gantz. Just about any former Democratic presidential candidate or their campaign manager that I've talked to some. Joe Rosebars, Harold Ickes, Nate Silver, Marty Baron. Lots of people. Oh, and Sarah Silverman.
Lastly, what do you see in the future for the podcast?
I don't seem to have a clear vision for the future of the podcast. I sometimes think about getting help and putting out clean transcripts and actually doing some marketing or writing something up that synthesizes the learning or revamping the way I ask questions, trying to make it more entertaining, but then I don't make those changes. So I guess I see the future most probably as a continuation of what I'm already doing, and I hope I'm gradually improving as an interviewer. I welcome any advice or suggestions. That was Nathaniel G. Perlman and the first part of my 1,000th episode. A ton of more questions remain for me to try to answer in the next episode. I hope you enjoyed it so far. You can find me at greatbattlefield.com or graphicacy.com. I always appreciate feedback, so send me reactions, good or bad.